CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 106, with Professor Malik Hook, fostering innovation via translational research and all those patents. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest, my friend, Dr. Malik Hook at University of Colorado. You know his name from a lot of things. Probably the most popular device that I've been using for glaucoma is KDB that you invented, the Cahook dual blade. But you're also a big inventor with 80 patents. Blows my mind to think about it. Well, welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've been a big fan. At 3:01 a.m. Mountain Time, I get the email with the video each day. So I've been watching and enjoying while on the road or in Denver. So it's
thank you.
Follow.
Yeah, our Cataract Coach videos, I posted at 5 a.m. East Coast time, 2 a.m. California, 3 a.m. Mountain Time, because I want the East. My number one market is USA. Number two is India. Three is Brazil. But I want all the USA surgeons to be able on the East Coast to have the video in their inbox when they have that early morning coffee. And that's why I choose that time.
You know, I've noticed on some of your videos, some of the interviews that you're doing, that you go metric sometimes, just so the whole global audience will understand. So we'll go metric today if I have to mention kilometers instead of miles or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's obviously in medicine, we're only metric.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that when you're an American, I lectured in 21 countries last year. And wow. This USA is the only country that's going to talk about like miles and degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. Yeah.
I'll try to get a conversion there.
Should be something that's not taught in school as much as it is, because it gets confusing for the kids as well.
Right. Now let me just start talking about when you started doing glaucoma. You were at University of Pittsburgh with some famous people, right? Joel Schulman and then also Rob Noecker.
Yeah.
And tell me how that 1 year in Pittsburgh affected kind of your outlook on glaucoma, on ophthalmology, and how to manage scientist, inventor, plus clinician, surgeon.
Yeah, I think when we look back at our training, we look at who our mentors were, the formative years, and how we developed sort of the way we were thinking. And Pittsburgh was certainly that for me. The way that I ended up in Pittsburgh, I did residency here in Colorado. My wife, who's also a physician, was in medical school at the time, splitting time between Ohio and here. We're both from Ohio. So Pittsburgh was a great place. And it just so happened that one of the giants of ophthalmology, Joel Schulman, was there. And for those of you who know the name Rob Noecker, it's a common name that I think a lot of people in ophthalmology know. He's one of the best surgeons in ophthalmology. So I had great training. Joel had just joined his chair 2 years prior to that. I think I was his first or second fellow. Mm-hmm. He had some grads from outside the country. I think I might have been the first U.S. fellow. And the most formative thing was just hanging out with Joel. And when you walk into Joel's office, when he was in Pittsburgh, he's now at Wills. When you walk into his office, he has a wall of his patents sitting right above the couch that you would sit on as a fellow, where he would quiz you for a couple of hours after clinic. And I remember looking up at those patents and starting to ask him some questions. How'd you go about doing that? Tell me about the OCT pathway at Harvard. Learned a ton from that. And that relationship was maintained after coming back to Colorado, where Joel's always quick to pick up the phone. We meet for breakfast at all of the major meetings. So that relationship, I think, was one of the key relationships for me as an inventor and as a clinician. Great clinician, great surgeon. He taught me a lot in all aspects of my career.
Now, in your office there in Denver, do you have a big wall of all your patents so that your fellows can get inspired?
You know, this is really funny. I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later, but how you change through your career is, I'm sure you're going through this and you're doing some transitions now. You were in academia half-time, now you're private practice full-time. Right. So for me, what I've noticed is that I started off trying to go as fast as I could and my walls were full. I tried to put everything on there. You know, did I get, you know, something from Academy, put it up there. And what I've noticed now when I walk into my office and the residents and my partners notice this, the walls are bare.
Right.
I put everything into a box. I have a bunch of boxes in the basement. I'm sitting in my house right now. And they just never made them back up to the wall. I just took them down saying, hey, let's do a refresher. I do have a KDB patent that I keep in my loft upstairs in the office that I use. That's about it, though. A lot of it is just memories in here, sitting in there.
But you've been prolific. I mean, from what I read, 80 plus patents and like half of them already licensed to ophthalmic companies. This is amazing.
Yeah, we've certainly been lucky and surrounded by a bunch of really good people. Maybe I can tell you a little bit that I know that you have a range of people who listen in from training all the way through, you know, senior ophthalmologists. And a common question that I get, I just did this podcast for ASCRS for young ophthalmologists, just talking about the pathway. And for me, one of the other formative things in my career that happened was a new chairman took over when I was in fellowship, Naresh Mandava, a retina specialist. He took over here in Colorado while I was in my fellowship. And he recruited me back to start the glaucoma service. And as part of that, he gave me a startup package to start a device lab. And we were off and running from that point. So we had the funds to start projects internally that we came up with, but also to work with various startups where they came to us for some of their preclinical work. If they were early on in the stage of their development, they would come into us and we had a full team. We had engineers. We had a really nice ecosystem here. And so that created the foundation to start devices like KDB. We started a company called ClareVista that spun out of here into an incubator in Minnesota and California that was eventually acquired by Alcon in 2017. That experience allowed me to meet a whole bunch of business people, engineers, patent attorneys. Right. And then equally important was all the venture capitalists that I met who invested in ClareVista, who are now investing in our current company, Spyglass Pharma. So a lot of luck along the way, meeting a lot of people, I think networking, talking to people, and following through. Right. I always tell the residents when I give a sort of life talk, that probably the best thing you can do is answer your email and answer your texts right away. Mm-hmm. So you emailed me a couple of months ago and I was about to travel and we were talking about doing this and I answered you right away saying, hey, give me a few weeks, right? Mm-hmm. I have some things that I need to do. And I think that's really important. It's a show of respect. Yeah. And you get a lot of opportunities if you just answer your phone. So I would encourage everybody to do that. Don't be overwhelmed, have your vacation, but also be respectful and follow through.
I think that's so important. Like I always know, if I email someone once, try again, another time, and still no reply, I'm like, that tells me more than anything else could have told me. I know that it's like, stay away, you have no interest, or you're too flaky, or you're going to drive me crazy, I'm out.
Yeah. You can have somebody who's very high functioning, who's, you know, the smartest person in the room, but if they're not following through, all of that is sort of wasted on any project that you want to do, and if you're writing a book, if you're... you know, I listened into some of your interviews in the past where there was talk about, you know, getting physicians to do chapters for you. Really hard to do that, right? Because a lot of us are doing chapters and it's one of the hardest things that we do. But you want to go to the people that are going to follow through. It's just so important in what we do. You don't want to have to continue to call and email and try and nudge people. You just want people who want to be excited about doing things.
Right. I had a situation when I was teaching residents maybe 5, 6, 8 years ago. And someone came to me and said, would you do an entire section of this book? It's all cataract refractive. And I said, okay, I'll do these. I asked all the residents, all 24 of our residents, if you'd like to do a book chapter, you will do the lion's share of the work, but I promise I will help you. I'll guide you. We'll get it done. You can get a book chapter done as a resident.
Yeah.
And maybe like 10 said yes. I'm like, okay. These are people who want to do it, they'll do it. And when the deadlines came, 7 actually followed through and 3 I just had to write their chapters. It's like, but you told me you'd do this.
Yeah, painful. That's painful. But it's also informative, right? And usually those are the people who kind of continue. It's kind of in their DNA. They do that. But the doers, it's also in their DNA. And if you can find that group and hold on to them, I'll give you an example. So if you look at our service, our glaucoma service, which we started, this is year 19 for me right now in Colorado. Okay. This went by really fast. If you look at our team, it's mostly people that did fellowship with me.
Okay.
And the one who didn't was a resident with Joel when I was a fellow with Joel.
Okay. So, you know,
so I knew her really well. Right. And if you just walk around our service, those are the doers, that came in. We had other great fellows who for family reasons didn't, you know, weren't able to stick around, but every single one of them had a very long interview process with me. They were residents and fellows or fellows with me. So I really got to understand the doers from those who maybe weren't as active in following through. And that has created an amazing environment on the glaucoma service. Every single one is in a leadership role within the department. I know I can rely on them. They can see any family member at any time. And I know they're going to be taken care of. They can do surgery on me when I need it, which might not be far away from my cataracts, right? So I think I'm a big believer in betting on people who show you that they do show up, right?
Right. And you said also some degree of luck. But you know what? The harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah.
It's funny how that ends up, you know, panning out.
Yeah, you can. I get calls and emails from people who are trying to follow the path of starting devices and companies. And what I like to tell anybody who is listening, anybody who wants the time to sort of understand what little wisdom I've gained over the years.
Sure.
And that is, if you're going fast right off the bat, you're going to get a lot of attention. Right. So you might put yourself in a position where you're being recognized by industry, by the trade journals, and your name is in shining lights. But really slow is where the power is. So fast attention, slow power, and staying power, great foundation. And that's where you get a lot of your luck that just kind of shows up. You've been there, you're doing the hard work, you're showing up. Things tend to happen for those people, right? Because you're not going so fast that you don't notice the opportunities as they're coming to you. And I think that's a really important distinction when you're first starting out your career.
Right. You could, if the flame burns really bright at the beginning, may peter out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. I made that mistake. I don't know if you did. I mean, you kind of, I remember being on airplanes going Hawaiian Eye and you were a few rows ahead of me, you know, so there, you know, there are times in our career where we're running really fast. I did it. I certainly did it. I remember, you know, I'll tell you, this is a good podcast for sharing. I remember my first 2 years out of fellowship, I was doing a lot of industry stuff. And I'm not really, you know, I'm more introverted. I don't want to be on stage all the time. You don't see me at all the meetings for multiple days. I like to come home, spend time with my son and with my wife. But I remember waking up in El Paso, lovely city, love the people there. But this company put me in a motel right by a used car dealership. The night before I was giving my talk, and I remember opening up, you know, the window and just looking out and saying, I can't keep doing this. I have to have better things to do with my life. And so I started to slow it down from there and really focusing, putting all of my time and energy into something that I thought had staying power. And for me, that ended up being a research, worked on a book called Chandler Grant, which is, you know, in glaucoma, one of our seminal textbooks. I put a lot of time into that with Joel. And then started the devices and the companies. And I felt like, okay, I can spend a lot more time in Denver just building this foundation around those components.
Yeah, I think we all go through that. I think in your early, mid-30s, when you want to get your name out there, you do a lot of the stuff for the companies and they will use you very frequently. You know, hey, you want to speak for us? Sure, they'll line you up a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But then you think at the other time, you know, and what am I really doing here? What am I actually doing?
Yeah.
It is good to help build your name, get your name out there. It's kind of fun to meet new people, see new cities. I get that. But you're not doing it on your own terms. And so I had a similar situation where I got a letter in the mail back in the old U.S. post office days. And it said, congratulations, you made our diamond status for this hotel chain. And I'm like, wow, sweet. Until I read it. And then it says, because you stayed 63 nights in hotels last year. And I was like, oh, my God, I spent one sixth of the year in these hotels. What am I doing?
Yeah. Yeah. And we have friends that are really smart people that do great jobs, you know, when they're giving their talks and they enjoy doing that. And the family is sort of accepting of that. I can tell you for me, one of the main things is staying home as much as I can, hanging out with my son as much. We have one, he's 12 years old and he's so much fun to be around. So as much as possible, I'm here. Now I still travel for the startup companies. I still, you know, go to different, I work a lot with Orbis International now.
I read that.
There is a significant amount of travel. I try to bring them with me when they can come. And then instead of staying for 3 days or three nights for a meeting, I go for one night and I come back home and I go to the soccer games and I make sure that I'm there. It just makes a big difference in my happiness.
Yeah. So I did the same thing. I actually one day made this realization I'm traveling too much and not spending enough time with my own kids. So I actually stopped going to all trips, all meetings, all academy, all answers. Just stop. Instead, I'm going to do family trips. Fun stuff. Took my kids to Europe for a month when they were like, you know, same age, 10, 12, 13 years old. And now my kids are both in their early 20s. They're both gone. And I'm so happy because they will never come back home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're done.
You got the chance to do that stuff with them at the right time, right?
Right. So that does make sense. And I also changed gears too. Now, I like still work, love to work with industry and ophthalmology. So I think it's amazing. But I would rather do what you're doing now. The companies I work with now, I have an ownership stake. I have leadership roles within that small startup. And to me, that's a lot more exciting than working for the big, huge companies, which are great too, but it's just, you're just a small cog in the wheel.
Yeah. If you can compare sort of working with the big companies, there's nothing wrong with the big companies. I think I certainly benefited from meeting and working with and learning from the bigger companies. But compare that to the work that you're doing with Horizon, for example. So right. You're on a ground floor with the robotic surgery. There are only a couple of players, you know, if you can, you can count Foresight, Horizon, maybe a couple of others that are a little bit more quiet. But you get a chance to build the technology for the next 10, 20, 30 years. So you're just in a different place in your life. And I try to do that stuff with the companies, with Spyglass or with New World, do a significant amount of work with New World, Dr. Ahmed and the family at New World Medical. And that, to me, that's what makes me happy today. So I think we should each find what makes us happy.
Yeah, and that changes. And, you know, 20 years ago in my career, I would just wanted different things. But now I'm kind of at this point, I want this right now. And maybe 20 years in the future, it'll be something different still.
Yeah, and we're blessed that we have the choice, right? So we can sort of wake up one day and say, hey, today I'm about robotic surgery. And maybe tomorrow, you know, I'm going to do episode 5,000 of my podcast, whatever it is you're on. You're on 2,300 plus right now, I think, of
yeah, 20. By the time this podcast airs, we're past 2,500 videos.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. I have questions about that. You know, when I was emailing with you, I said, hey, can I ask you some questions? And maybe we can get back to that. But, you know, when you're, so you're talking about startups, I'm just going to ask you now, right? So you're talking about startups and some of the things you enjoy doing. To do 2,500 straight episodes, whether it's surgical with narration or these, you know, podcast interviews that you're doing, that takes a lot of energy, takes a lot of effort. Do you see this going on for an extended period of time where you continue doing it, or is this leading to something else? Do you have something in your mind where this is going to evolve into a different kind of platform or different service for ophthalmologists?
That is a great question. So yeah, first, it is a tremendous amount of work. And if you're an ophthalmologist, I'll ask you, why don't you go ahead and make a video, 5 minutes, edit some video, do a voiceover,
yeah,
get it rendered, make a title slide, upload it, do everything. Tell me how long that takes you.
Yeah.
And then the other side, I'd say, do you know anyone, if you say to them, make me a new video every day for 2,500 days in a row, never miss a day, ever?
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
I could do it. But in my life, though, honestly, I made up for not being as smart as most people. As most ophthalmologists. Ophthalmologists are incredibly smart. I'm smart enough, but I'm a donkey when it comes to work.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, well, if this contest, who can work harder, I don't mind if I will die before I let you win. If it's hard work, I'll win.
Yeah. So that's kind of like what we started with, talking about answering email, answering phone calls.
Right.
You can be the smartest person. And we all work with geniuses, right? We know who they are in our field. People who are just, you know, different, right? They're just really, really intelligent. But if you can work, it sounds like a conversation I have with my son, right? We talk about this all the time, about hard work, not cutting corners, what it means to actually distinguish yourselves from others and have pride in your work. Right. I think if you do those things, great, but you've taken it to a different level. You know, during the pandemic, I started a series of YouTube videos that I actually did for Orbis because I was trying to go through the glaucoma basic science series book, and it was one slide in 5 minutes. So I made one slide with a basic concept, pigmentary glaucoma, pseudoexfoliation glaucoma, and then the narration would be no more than 5 minutes. Sounds pretty simple, right? Then you sit at your computer and you start and you're like, well, that didn't sound right. Or I forgot that part. I have to go back. Then you learn how to use all the editing equipment. Right. Then at the next video for me, if it were a couple of weeks later, I'd forget how to use the editing equipment, have to relearn it. You're doing this every single day. And, you know, I found myself thinking as I was watching some of your videos, I was watching the Rich Davidson video, my partner, Rich Davidson, right? His office is right next door to mine. So I saw his face. I'm like, I got to watch this right away. And I'm just, you know, watching this, and he's really good and he can do things in one take and there's no editing involved. Really, it's just the two friends talking, right? But there are circumstances with the videos that you're doing surgically where it takes a lot of effort. I mean, you're going to have to sit there and figure out how to present it as best you can for ophthalmologists. It's just a tremendous amount of work, right? I can't imagine every day.
The tough part too is, even though I'm in Los Angeles, could I hire a Hollywood professional level video editor? No, because they don't even know what capsular access means. How do I give them a 45 minute surgery and say, make it, edit it down to 5 minutes of just the important things? They have no idea.
Well, you have a ton of data right now. And I mean that in a nice way, not in a sterile sort of you know, data way, that it could turn into something even bigger. And I wonder what that might look like.
Oh, right? I'll tell you, I already know. Okay, so cataract coach is already on. Cataract coach is already anterior segment. So it's cataract, glaucoma, cornea, refractive. It's all anterior segment. So we're already doing all those videos. In fact, I've rebranded. You see that I have those four words, cataract, glaucoma, cornea, refractive, and the thing. As of March 1, we have retinarounds.com, my sister channel.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
So the sister channel, Retina Rounds, is going to, you know, it's Pradeep Prasad, who was a former resident 15 years ago, a ridiculously amazing retina surgeon and great teacher. And that's the same format. And so we're also now, my monthly column in Ocular Surgery News is already is Cataract Coach branded. I just went last weekend at OSHA Telling It Like It Is meeting where they gave me an hour for Best of Cataract Coach.
Wow.
At the ASRS coming up in April, they've given me a full symposium. It was the most popular course, highest rated and most popular course for the last few years.
That's amazing.
And the problem was it was always a fire hazard, like a fire marshal hazard, because the room was so packed and standing room only that it was like not allowed because of fire issues. So now I have these, I've given it one of the 10 or 12 symposia with the mega room. And I'm sitting here trying to edit those videos to make sure I have a really good, you know, good event there. But I think it's all the above. And at some point, I certainly anticipate doing a cataract coach actual meeting in person.
Yeah.
Because the format's a little different. And then I take pride in what I do. I really have to do a great job. Like at OSHA's meeting last year, I don't have this year's data yet. Well, out of the 94 speakers, I was ranked one.
Wow.
OSHA was two. And I had to apologize and said, Bob, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to, you know, come out and, you know, outshine here. But I really take pride.
Sure that well, yeah.
So I think it's all the above, and it's just a neat way of doing things. And it's why I expanded to a podcast about 100 something episodes ago. It's why I have a curriculum series. It's why I have the PDF book, and we'll expand that as well to even have more things involved. And yes, I've already had offers for some media companies who want to buy me.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about. Yeah. Hold on to it a little bit longer. Yeah.
But even if I do, I have no plans of doing that right now. Even if I do, I'd want to still have like a guaranteed role.
Yeah.
Because at some point I'm the brand.
Right. For sure. And I like the idea of a meeting, you know, so Telling It Like It Is, Hawaiian Eye, the different branches of Hawaiian Eye, multiple meetings. We have a lot of meetings in ophthalmology and still a lot of interest in each individual one. I think it'd be great to have a meeting where you could do it for young ophthalmologists who are just learning and sure. what to do. And then sort of mid-career and senior, I think that would be a great brand to have a meeting around.
Yeah, I think so too. Just a brief meeting, you know, just a little quick weekend somewhere. But we'll see at some point. There's no rush in doing this.
Yeah.
I think 2025, I just want to continue growing it. I mean, Cataract Coach itself has more than 1 million views a month now. It's bananas numbers. I just never thought you can get to this.
Let's see what this episode gets. So I'll be watching to see how many ticks you get on your YouTube channel for this one. So
the YouTube with this will be about 1,000 views. So only about 1,000 people actually watch the video of it.
But I have a family day. I can get a lot of my family members to just click for you. Yeah.
Your son will teach you how to like auto click it or something.
Yeah, yeah, he can do that.
Click a box. But then also it gets 10 times that number on audio downloads, at least.
That's amazing.
So most people actually just stream it through Spotify, Amazon, Apple, Google, whatever podcast service, and only a small percent, usually single digits, actually watch the actual video.
Huh. Yeah, I've been watching the videos. I find it, you know, so I was watching Daryl White's video.
Long
ago, because I'm getting in touch with Daryl and starting to get to know him a little bit. His practice is not far away from where I grew up, so we
kind of
connected.
Westlake, Ohio.
Yeah, so he's in Westlake. I grew up in Akron, Ohio. My wife is from Cleveland, Ohio. So Daryl and I have been sort of circling each other, and you know, I found it because I don't know him really well. Just kind of watching him and his mannerisms, his demeanor is just a really kind person, great guy, right? So I think the videos actually add a lot when you can watch. But audio also, I mean, I do a lot of walking now. When the pandemic started, we did a lot of Zoom and Teams. And a couple of months in, I said, you know what? Every meeting that I'm having will be a walking meeting. So I started walking around my neighborhood, listening to things. And in between calls, I would do podcasts. So I think yours would be a really nice thing to listen to in between those calls and, you know, have some time for learning along the way.
Oh, I think that's great. Oh, you'll really enjoy working with him. He's just a fantastic guy and probably my favorite writer in all of ophthalmology.
Yeah, I follow his blog, and if you like on X, I guess we call it now, instead of Twitter, he sometimes will tag me on there to make sure that I'm getting it because he knows that I'm traveling, you know, abroad. And I love reading those things about his family, about his mother, things like that. He is a really good writer. He takes pride in his sentence structure as well. So
it was never my forte, I'll tell you right now.
Yeah, he does it much better than I can, I'll tell you that.
But yeah, I think you're saying now you're doing a little more traveling. I think watch when your son goes off to university, and if he's going to be like my kids, he's going to go far, far away.
Yeah.
And then you'll find yourself like last year, I actually did 21 countries, but not in a bad way because it was on my terms. I said, I probably got 40 invites to countries. I turned down half. I wanted 21. I really enjoyed. I had a great time. I went a lot of times. I took a couple extra days for just fun and sightseeing. And now it's not bad. And then, of course, now that my kids are gone, it's like I've got all the time in the world.
Yeah. You know, so I'm doing it differently. I can tell you my first 10 years out, I was traveling. And my son, again, he was born 12 years ago. So it was kind of like the process after he was born. I was still doing that. Now I do it differently. So I don't travel for as many days. But if I'm going, I'll give you an example. So I went to Mongolia a few months ago for Orbis, and I was there for about 8 days. Every night I was able to sit down and FaceTime with my son and teach him about Mongolia. I had some of the members of the that were on the Orbis trip actually sit down and talk to him, teach him about what we were doing. So it became an educational experience for him. And I try and do that. You know, so when you were emailing with me originally, I said, you know, I'm going to do some traveling. I did a short amount of travel for work, but then my son and my wife met me and we went to Barcelona for a soccer game. My son's really into soccer.
That's so cool.
And that turned into a great thing where they were able to come and join. We were able to just have a family, you know, vacation around Christmas time. So I try and do that more and more where I combine the two, short work and then longer for the family just to have fun and spend time with each other.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm glad to hear you doing that. Now, tell me about your work with Orbis, because you mentioned you're working with Orbis. You've got a big leadership role. What are you doing with Orbis?
So a lot of the audience, I think, will know Hunter Cherwick, who is, he directs the plane. He's an ophthalmologist trained at Emory. And on the day of his graduation, he left and basically got on the Orbis plane. So he's been doing this for same age as me. So he's been doing this for about 20 years. He took a little hiatus during his time, about halfway through his time with Orbis, and he started working for Alcon, doing a lot of the FACO training in China, Russia, and India. And it was during that time that we met. We were introduced by mutual friends at a big meeting somewhere. I think it was in India. It was out of the country. And we just hit it off. Great guy, really honest and earnest, just the kind of person that you want to hang out with. And then when he jumped back into Orbis, I was an early phone call where he said, okay, it's time to start working with Orbis. And so I started doing lectures. If the audience is familiar with Orbis, maybe take a look at their library and cyber site. There's a lot of free educational material there.
Sure.
So I hopped on the plane in Barbados, did a nice session there where I learned as much as I taught, you know, how these things work. Great ophthalmologist who had a lot of great experience. I remember doing a tube on a patient, seeing the thickest tenons I've ever worked with.
Wow.
And telling that to the surgeon who was from Guyana, saying, yeah, this is everybody. What are you talking about? They all look like this. So I learned a ton from that. And when I came back, I joined the medical advisory committee to start with, and then eventually joined the full board. So I'm a director on the Orbis board. Which is great. I get to sit down, have a front row seat. I get to go to places like Mongolia and teach. I think one of the best things that Orbis has provided me personally is the connection to different ophthalmologists around the world. Wherever I go, each country that I go to, I have a WhatsApp group that I form. I'm constantly getting videos, pictures. Hey, what do I do here? I'm in clinic or I'm in the operating room. This is happening. What do I do? And I'm just excited for the future of Orbis. The educational offering and the collaborative effort of upskilling people rather than doing the care, right? We're upskilling people who live in their area because that's who's taking care of the patients. I think Orbis is the best in the world at doing that. It's been a privilege to work with Orbis.
Oh, that's really neat. I'm glad you're doing that.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun and I probably get out of it more than I'm giving. And, now the question is, where do I go to next? So we're kind of looking at that to see where the next educational trip's going to be. Maybe you and I can go one day and we can
sign me up.
That'd be great.
You know, actually, since I stopped doing my university duties, just half-time basically and half-time private practice, I actually just do private practice half-time.
So you have time now.
I have plenty of time, but part of it is I travel so much. And the other part is that I'm making these videos and doing this project, but I'm also involved with, as you mentioned, Horizon Surgical for the robotic stuff. I'm also involved with LensGen for Comring IOL. I'm also involved with a couple other project companies. One is like, we just got a new patent in AI lens calc stuff last month or 2 months ago as of this podcast airing. And so That's so all those things take so much time. So I actually work from home 2-3 days a week getting all that done.
Yeah. So you're touching on something else that I think is pretty important. So if you look at what you just named, so Horizon, I'm familiar with, LensGen with Ron, Sam Garg is a close friend. Right. So, you know, I've heard a lot about what LensGen is doing and then bringing AI into it. Right now, as ophthalmologists, we're being exposed to so many things that will change the world in the next 1 to 2 decades, right?
Right.
Robotics. I was showing my son yesterday a video of a humanoid robot from a company called Figure that was putting away groceries, right? Mm. So, and it was leveraging AI to see where are the eggs, and I put that in the fridge. Where are the chips? I put that in the cupboard, not in the fridge. We're seeing that in ophthalmology at a scale that the public isn't seeing at this point. So we're privileged to really learn this. I've taken courses in AI from Harvard, trying to learn the basics. I remember when I was watching Rich Davidson's video with you, he mentioned the same thing, because we have a strong presence of AI in our department. It's pretty exciting to see these things and have our hands on them before a lot of people in the community.
Right.
And you get the chance to kind of combine them in a way, because you're working with these various companies. You might be sitting with LensGen saying, wait a second, there's this AI LensCal company that might be able to make things better, or to Horizon. What if we got you together with some of the AI people so that the surgical maneuver that you're doing is a little bit smoother, right? Again, we're privileged to be working with so many different talented people, I think.
Oh, absolutely. It's really neat. In fact, I saw that in the last year or two, you've got about a dozen publications related to ChatGPT or AI in glaucoma.
Yeah, we're starting to do so. In 2022, we had a fund set up so that we could recruit an AI team. It was something that my chairman, Naresh Mandava, came up with. Again, he's a visionary. He's really changed our department. When I was a resident 20 years ago, we had 6 attendings. Now we have over 50 attendings who are operating in our department.
Wow.
We've just grown tremendously. And one thing he said was, hey, let's think about what to do in the future. What would be something to set ourselves up? And we had a long discussion about AI. We ended up recruiting a world leader, Jayshree Kalpathy Kramer from Harvard, to come and join us. She hit the ground running, formed a huge team, got a lot of grants, both local foundation as well as NIH grants. And so we're looking at this saying, we better get smarter on AI.
Mm-hmm, right.
Because we have this power horse who's really working hard. So ChatGPT is simple, right? When ChatGPT came out, you can just interact with it and learn the basics. I started taking courses, but now we've taken it to a different level. Also, so I took my son to school this morning, and some of you might be familiar with Gemini, which is Google's version of ChatGPT.
Right.
So there's Gemini 2.0 right now that I have on my phone. And my son was asking me some questions. He's learning some things in history, and he was asking me some questions. And I said, you know, there are other ways to learn about these things if you're focused on specific things. And I pulled up my phone when I was driving, and I put on Gemini, and I said, ask Gemini a question.
Okay.
And if you haven't done this, you should do this. Download Gemini and do this on your phone. And he started asking Gemini questions, and Gemini was answering and building on his questions. And for about 10 minutes, I'm just smiling while I'm driving, right?
Yeah.
10 minutes into it, he forgot that he was talking to Gemini. It was as if he was talking to me, because the interaction was so smooth. And this is where we're headed, right? So it started for me with ChatGPT, working on glaucoma, neuro. We've done a lot of investigation. But now I'm taking it to a different place, and that is, how can it be patient facing in a quicker way? How can we take care of the patient from the moment they walk in the door to the minute they walk out the door at every level, when they check in, when the technician is with them, when the doctor's with them, when they're getting signed up for surgery, pre-post-surgery, at home after surgery? This is stuff that AI is really going to help us with. We got to learn it. We got to learn it fast.
Yeah, you absolutely do. And even that keeps changing. Our patent that we did is 10 years in the making.
Wow.
Right now, it's very obvious. Like, of course, to figure out lens calcs or any kind of calcs in ophthalmology, we'll use AI.
Right.
I promise you, 10 years ago, it was not that intuitive. It was not that obvious.
No, I had no idea what AI was 10 years ago. For me, this is all brand new. This is the past 4 or 5 years, basically, right? I had no idea.
Well, our calculation stuff, my partner there is John Lattice. John's a brilliant ophthalmologist. We were first year residents together.
Wow.
Our saying was, when we were first year residents, we both trained at UCLA, between John, me, and the wheels manual, put all three of us together, we'll figure it out. So we, John and I each had like 10% of a brain. The wheels manual was like the other 80% that was missing. Together, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
So we obviously worked very closely together, but right around when we started residency in 1997, because I did residency in 97 to 2000, that's when IBM's Deep Blue beat Kasparov in chess.
Yeah.
And we, John and I, would talk like, this is going to be something. This is going to be something. I can't believe. And remember, back then, it was a huge mainframe computer that was literally fed in mountains of data of previous chess matches. And then finally, it beat Kasparov.
Yeah.
Well, now, fast forward after that, 20 years later, 2017, Google's AlphaZero, given the rules of chess, plays itself for 4 hours and beats anyone on the planet. Done.
Yeah.
That's how much it's come. So that's why we started, like, yeah, it was more than 10 years ago. So you know what? We need to have AI involved in the calculations here in surgery. And then we even solved the issue of, like, well, how do you get these crazy out-of-bounds numbers? Like, sometimes it'll come up with a crazy answer. Well, it's such an easy answer. What we did, we made a dog leash that choose whatever you want as the base formula, whether it's Holiday or Barrett, and then you're only allowing the AI to change it by one diopter or half diopter. That's the maximum leash.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's not so crazy. You don't get these out-of-bounds answers that are off by 10 diopters because the AI got confused with something.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that part where the AI is confusing things, because so here's what we're in danger of. And I don't think this is the case with what you're working on, because a lot of the data that you can put into your system is your data or colleagues' data. So it's clean. You know exactly what's going in. The danger for us that we have to be very much aware of is that a lot of the systems, the foundational systems that we're using, talk about public facing, not necessarily the scientific systems that we're using, they have input from everything. Right. And a lot of it is not correct. And a lot of it is maybe not the best advice, right?
Right.
Our patients are going to be using these things, right? So if a patient asks a question, and you can play around with Gemini and see this, it'll go to 10 different sites. It'll tell you maybe 8 things that are great, but maybe those 2 sites were just really off the wall, but AI doesn't know that. So it'll incorporate that into the answer. I'm super interested in how we clean that data up so that we don't have these unintended consequences of using AI. Think scientifically, as you mentioned, it's a big thing. You can do the bookends and you can say, don't really deviate from these, but the public is going to use all of these systems in a way we're not even imagining today, right?
Right.
So it's yesterday or the day before, I think it was yesterday, the days are starting to kind of melt into each other, but Microsoft was talking about a big breakthrough in quantum computing. Satya Nadella was talking about this. And I remember thinking, well, that's interesting. It's kind of like when I first heard about AI that, you know, I didn't know much about it. On a walk yesterday, I was thinking, wait a second, what if you take all of this progress in AI and you throw in quantum computing that essentially has zero limits to how fast it can go and what it can interpret? What if you put those two together? And now where are we? And that's kind of blowing my mind right now, trying to figure out in healthcare, how can we use that? It's just the world is changing a lot faster than it used to. Our residents have to keep up. Students have to keep up.
Right.
My son's going to have to keep up. It's stuff that I'm certainly paying attention to and trying to get smarter on.
Right. So I think the data in is a huge issue. So if you have like a ChatGPT, which is trained on, let's say, the whole internet, and now you can choose an ophthalmology-specific topic. You can go to ChatGPT, and you could have it tell you that certain vitamins will help get rid of your floaters.
Yeah.
Now, we all understand that there are no vitamins that get rid of your floaters. You have a few options. You can yag it. You can do a vitrectomy. You can just put up and shut up, which is my favorite way.
Right, right.
But because it got input from all these crazy sites all over the internet, as you said, 8 of those are pretty reasonable answers, but 2 of them were like, no, take vitamins and do this head massage and it'll fix your floaters.
Right.
But then I think the nice part is we're training it based on our own data. Like for us in the lens count stuff, we're only training it on not the whole internet, just our data for eyes.
Right.
It's a lot better. But even then for patient-facing stuff and patient education, which is a huge important issue, I guess we have to be very careful on the source that we use to train the AI.
Right. I mean, you have a much better position because of the data that you're putting in. With all of these conversations around AI, you know, I'm very interested in learning more about AI, but with my son, I'm also more concerned about how to keep that human touch going. So in ophthalmology, we've mentioned a couple of names already, the people that we know in common that are friends. Probably, I would say top three things in ophthalmology is when we go to meetings and we see our friends. I have Rich Davidson on one side of me at work. I have Mike Taravella on the other side. You know, really people, they both taught me how to do cataract surgery, right? Right. I can talk to them about anything. That human touch is really important and how to continue doing that. My career is where it is because I met people, stayed in touch with them, helped them, and they helped me. There was no AI interface there.
Mm-hmm,
there
was no right.
computing happening. And I'm also interested in how, you know, the Zoom, the Teams, the Google meeting, all of these things that are happening, they're great. They keep us in touch, but we have to maintain that face-to-face, grabbing a cup of coffee, making right. sure that we get to understand who the person is, who their kids are, you know, what does their spouse do? Where do they live? What do they mm-hmm. like? You know, these are things that you're not going to get if you're just facing a computer all the time.
In fact, that's probably the most important thing of going to a meeting right. are these social interactions you have with your colleagues, your friends, et cetera, because arguably, even I'll present at the, you know, big meeting, all these best of cataract coach cases, but you'll find them on your phone on my cataract coach website. You can watch them anytime you want.
Right, right.
You don't have to watch them live in person. You can watch them on your phone anytime.
Yeah, it's different when you have somebody sitting next to you and it's alive and you're like, oh, did you see that? Did you see what Uday right. said? I totally disagree with that. I can't believe yeah. he said that, right? It's a totally different experience. I'll give you another example. So sure. So Spyglass Pharma is one of the companies that spun out of the university about 5 years okay. ago. So in that company, if you just walk through and you look at the different offices that are in there, the CEO is Patrick Mooney. I met Patrick Mooney when I was a resident and he was the district manager for Alcon 20 years ago, right? He then went on to Novartis and we recruited him away to be CEO. The head of the CTO is Glenn Sussman. Glenn is my co-founder. I met him when I was presenting ECP to Alcon 17 years ago.
Right.
So you meet these people and you have relationships with them. You break bread with them. You get to know them mm-hmm. and you really gravitate towards the people that you get along with, that you learn from, that make you feel good about yourself and you can make them feel good. That's stuff that we have to really cherish and make sure we don't lose in this environment where digital media might be taking us away because of our phone, but then mm-hmm. you're in meetings and people are showing up and getting to know each other. I think that's really the key. And I hope we don't lose that.
I think you're right. Now tell me about Spyglass. So Spyglass Ophthalmics, what do you make? I already know, but for our audience.
So after we sold Clarivista to Alcon 2017, we took a little bit of time off. And then Glenn Sussman, many of your audience members might know Glenn. So he used to work for Alcon for a long time. He worked on things like Aqualase, if you remember that from a long yeah. time ago. When he exited after the acquisition, he actually joined me at the university as an entrepreneur in residence. Mm-hmm. And we just sat down with a whiteboard and we said, okay, what do we want to do next? And we thought, and I still think that drug delivery is the next frontier. In glaucoma, we've had a decade and a half of MIGS. So KDB is part of that. We have a lot of devices. If you look at, you know, the New World portfolio, they just launched something new yesterday, day before yesterday.
Streamline.
Streamline came out and then Via 360, which is homeborn in New World, just launched. So we have a lot of nice things in MIGS. We have a lot of, you know, Glaukos, great company, Hydrus with Alcon, great. And I think we have a lot of different options. What we don't have is a way to use our medications that are quite effective, like the prostaglandin analogs, in a way that takes away the downside of patient adherence, right? Mm-hmm. So one example is Durysta, injectable into the eye, delivers bimatoprost for a few months. iDose just recently got approved. It delivers travoprost for a year or so, depending on which study you're looking at. Spyglass is trying to do things differently. So we have a hydrophobic acrylic intraocular lens, and on either haptic optic junction is a dispenser that delivers 3 years of bimatoprost. The dispensers themselves don't change in size or shape. Mechanically, they remain the same even after all of the drug is dispensed. So you put them on an intraocular lens, you inject into the capsular bag, any cataract surgeon has the skill set to do this. There's no angle surgery. There's no rotating the patient's head or the microscope. Right. There's no gonioscopy. Put it into the capsular bag. And it delivers for a period of 3 years, going in through a standard incision using a standard injector. We started the company about 5.5 years ago. A lot of the same investors that had invested in Clear Vista. And we did our first in-human study that found mid 40% IOP lowering from washed out baseline, which wow. to me is a big wow. Like,
yeah, that's great. Never
seen anything like that. We then moved into our phase two, and we just recently announced that we completed our phase two enrollment. So we're marching along for the phase three sometime this year. Pretty excited about getting this into phase three and eventually into commercialization. Now, along the way, we're also working with different medications. We're with bimatoprost right now, but we're looking at other glaucoma medications, medications for AMD, for different retina diseases. And we also have other generational devices that will allow us to do different things, especially after that first 3 years is up with the initial implant.
Right.
We have a method to actually go in for three or more years with other technologies.
Oh, very interesting. So if you don't know what this is, I'll put a link down below for our podcast. But they're little tiny donuts or rings
yep.
that you basically put on the haptic. So they sit at the haptic-optic junction, don't affect the eye well in any way.
Layer bio.
It's just a way of fixating them in the eye, and then they slowly release the meds over 3 years, which is amazing.
So this is this Layer Bio, the company Layer Bio, or is that, or no?
Are you talking about what you're doing?
Oh, so there's two different things. So there's a ring that delivers drug, a company called Layer Bio that came out. Ours is a little bit different than a ring. It's actually a pad that sits connected in that same space in the haptic optic junction. The rings that are out there that some people might be aware of are biorotable, biodegradable. For us, it was really important. Once you put something in the capsular bag, you don't want the lens position to change.
Right.
So we made sure.
You have a flat top.
That's right. Flat top marries to the capsule in a way that doesn't change. And I think that's the lasting power of what we're doing. That's why we're continuing to get the investment. We're continuing to enroll and doing well. I think you don't want to mess around with intraocular lenses. You have to provide the service of correcting vision and do it in a great way. And all of our results show that we have best in class performance from that standpoint. And then the glaucoma is being taken care of by the bimatoprost. Super excited about that. Yeah.
So no change in the effective lens position because the top of your device is basically flat.
Right. That's why I wanted to distinguish between some of the things that are out there. In our case, flat and doesn't change in mechanical properties or in thickness. It's not like it's dispensing and shrinking. It just stays exactly the same.
That's really neat. Yeah, of course. That's obviously important to keep that effective lens position so you can have your predictable refractive outcomes here.
Right. That's right.
But let's talk back to Clear Vista. That was a neat idea. That was an idea of that Harmony lens where you could put a base in and then just change the optic out. So if the patient needed a change in the refractive outcome of the eye, you can go back in the eye. The haptics and the base were already fused in the bag, the capsular bag, but you could take out the center optic and swap it for a new one.
Yeah. So Clear Vista was born in a very interesting way. So I was at, talk about meeting people and having discussions. I was at Hawaiian Eye sitting poolside, and Dave Van Meter, who was CEO of Ivantis, was there, and we were having a discussion. And at the end of the discussion, he's like, I have this guy I need you to meet. His name is Ali Babahani. He's one of the venture partners at NEA, big venture group that you might be aware of. And so I met with Ali and we were talking and he's like, do you have any good ideas? We're looking at investments in ophthalmology. And I presented three things to him that I was working on in the lab. And the one that he focused on was addressing refractive surprise, rotational stability, and also effective lens position, making it less of guesswork. And that's what Clear Vista was. So a base goes in, that base makes the lens position known. You can do imaging, figure out exactly where the base is sitting. That's where the optic is going to sit after you put it in. It does not rotate at all. The rotational stability was best in class. And let's say you put a panoptics in and for whatever reason, the patient isn't happy. Now you have the ability to go in and change out to a monofocal, to a standard toric, whatever you might need to do. So we spun that out. It went into an incubator and that incubator grew the technology. And that was a huge learning experience for me. Probably the best thing for me out of Clear Vista was the learning experience.
Right.
I understood what not to do, what to do. Recruited Glenn Sussman out of Alcon. So we got to know each other really well. And that's what led to him working with me in Spyglass. And then what we don't learn in medical school or residency is, what is venture capital? How do you raise money? What the heck is a Series A? You know, we never say these things when we're in training. So I started reading a bunch of books, meeting with as many people as possible. That certainly set me up for the next things that I did after that. Clairvista went on for about 5 years. Eventually Alcon came in, and it was at a time when Alcon was acquiring different companies. They acquired PowerVision at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They acquired Clairvista.
You hit a home run on that one, man. I Googled it.
Wowza. Yeah. We did well as a team. And that set us up also to say, okay, so what are we going to do next, right? PowerVision did really well. I think the technology hasn't made it to market for PowerVision. Look at Clairvista. That technology hasn't made it to market.
What do you mean? It's been 8 years.
Yeah, I think part of it for both PowerVision, Clairvista, and other technologies that are out there. I mean, you can look at, you know, without naming a lot of companies, there are a lot of companies that kind of get acquired, and a couple of things happen. I'll tell you my take on this. Yeah. Champions that bring in the technology often do really well, and then they move on to other things.
Right.
So the attention is a little bit different inside of the companies. But sometimes companies have acquisitions that then make sense from a patent portfolio standpoint to protect other things that they have, and they don't necessarily want to put it out there. Right. So it's really just kind of like the big companies, like the Alcons and the
Apple. They want to acquire the IP.
It's IP. And that's something certainly, you know, I can talk for hours about how to protect that and how to do it the right way. And Clairvista, I think, had, you know, for an IOL company to have an exit after 5 years is almost unheard of. So we were very happy with that outcome. But I can tell you what I'm focused on right now with the devices that we're working on is making sure, one of the things we do really well at the University of Colorado is we make sure that we get things to the patient. So more important than selling anything, more important than royalties or whatever it might be, you know, that's really secondary. Getting the technologies, you know, KDB has treated hundreds of thousands of patients. Nothing makes me happier than saying that out loud. It's a good feeling. So Spyglass, I'm hoping, is going to be exactly the same way. So we're looking at this as we're not selling Spyglass. We're going all the way to through, you know, a public offering. Now, you know, things always evolve, so we'll see how things work. But that's the plan today, that we're going to go to market and get this and hopefully get it in your hands and see how it works.
I think that'll be really neat. I mean, we as surgeons, we want more tools in the toolbox, right?
Yeah, yeah. Options. And I, you know, I always say this to the other companies that might be competitive to what I'm doing. I had a conversation like this with a CEO recently who might be seen as competitive. I think just like ophthalmologists, there's always room for good people and good things. So if you're moving to New York and you're like, there's an ophthalmologist on every corner, but yet you're very, very good, you're going to get business. You're going to be just fine. And it's the same thing with MIGS devices. It's the same thing with drug delivery. There's going to be room for anything that serves the patient. And I think that's a key thing. It's not about competing with others. It's not about, I got to beat this other person or this other technology. It's about, how do I do the best thing with what I'm working on? And I think everything else will take care of itself.
Yeah. Oh, so true. Compete with yourself, not against others. That is so important.
100%.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
Because ideally, you want to be competing in a new arena that does not yet exist that you're going to create. Now, speaking of which, if I got an ophthalmologist in this podcast right now, that ophthalmologist says, I got this really great idea and I want to pursue it. What's the steps in getting the ball rolling with the patents as someone who's done 80 of these or more?
Yeah. I would say send me an email and I'll tell you everything that I did wrong in the past. We're lucky that the patent system in the US is actually pretty predictable, right? So you can just kind of Google it and you can see how you file your provisional application and then how you build towards hopefully a granted patent. I think the keys to keep in mind is you're still, even if you hire a patent attorney, you're still the knowledge holder. You should still do a lot of the writing. Preferably, you would actually write the patent along with the potential claims even before you talk to the attorney, because it makes the communication smoother. And then through that process, make sure that you're in constant communication with whoever's drafting the final provisional application to make sure that they have everything right and that they speak ophthalmology, right? You don't always get a lawyer who is well-versed in ophthalmology. All of these things are extremely important. And I'll add one thing that I think is an important pearl when it comes to patent writing or filing for patents. there's a tendency to file for a provisional application with an idea, maybe a napkin, something that's drawn on the back of a napkin. Right. And then you kind of sit on it. You're like, it's a great idea, but you're not really doing the actual work to then feed the next stage of the patent. I think it's extremely important to get as much information as possible, proof of concept, data, all of that, so you can feed it into your patent so that it's much more powerful when it's granted. You want to just not the idea, but here's the supporting material for that idea. And that's not necessarily how ophthalmologists work. We're not in that world. But I think that's why it's you know, the other side to this, and I brought this up on that AskRis webinar that I was talking about earlier. We have the knowledge when it comes to the clinic. Now, some of us have learned about materials and engineering along the way, but I always talk about a triad when it comes to patenting or inventing. And that triad should involve a clinician, somebody who's an engineer or a scientist, depending on what you're working on, whether it's a device or mm-hmm. pharma product. And then you have to have a business entity with that triad, somebody who can tell you what's the market, what's the total addressable market, how do you get this thing to market, mm-hmm. how do you actually put a commercial message around it, how do you go out and talk to users and see how to make this thing better. I think you need all three of those components along with satellites around each one of them to really be successful with a business enterprise. Patent is a foundation, but those other pieces I think are extremely important as well.
Yeah, and give yourself a lot of time because it takes much longer than you think.
Yeah.
And it's so much work than you more than you anticipate. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. And it's getting harder. I was on a call earlier today with Glenn Sussman, who I mentioned a few times here. And there was a young engineer in the room. They're in California, so we're on Teams. And he was telling her, she's maybe 2-3 years out, she's very young. And he was saying, you know, at one point they tried to close the patent office because they thought everything that was patentable had been patented. And she looked at him like he was crazy. And I was like, no, he's telling the truth. Go look it up. This actually happened. So now we have so many patents in so many different areas. If you look up, you know, if you just go look up intraocular lens, you're going to get tens of thousands of hits. And there's these minor differences between each one of them. It's really important to be well-versed in those. But also that should tell you the expectation is it's going to take years to prove that there's novelty around something that you're trying to patent. Just so much material.
Right. And then keep in mind, some patents may seem like it's not even a patent, but it is. The idea of having two viscoelastics in one box is a patent.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Owned by Alcon, licensed to now J&J. Those are the only two companies that have two viscoelastics in one box. That is a patent. Or there's a patent of using a prostaglandin instead of treating glaucoma to grow your eyelashes.
Yeah. Murray Johnstone, who is one of the early sort of pioneers around prostaglandin analogs, when he saw these things happening, he started filing for IP on growing hair, which, you know, I could use a little bit here. Eyelashes, Latisse, of course, you know, developed into that. There's also a patent out there talking about fingernails, putting prostaglandin on fingernails because it actually helps them get thicker and longer. There's a lot of interesting stuff out there. And if you think about it, just go look it up. It's really easy to figure out what's out there. We call it prior art, right? So look at articles, look at books and what has been. Go to Duke Elder, because most things were thought of in Duke Elder, you know, decades ago. And then just go to the USPTO, to the patent office, and just do a search. Things will come up. Google has a nice patent search as well.
Right.
If you don't find anything, you might have something novel and unique. So you can look into it a little bit deeper.
Yeah, but if you really have an idea you're passionate about, definitely pursue it. Definitely. It's going to be a lot of work, a lot more than you think. It's going to take a long time, but it's so worth doing. And then the other thing that I didn't realize until later was, apply for as many claims as you want. Start thinking now when you have this idea. Okay, well, what are the claims you can have regarding that idea, regarding this patent?
Yep.
And list out all these, as many as you can, and then figure it out.
Yeah, you work with different lawyers who like to start with specs and go to claims and go to specs. I think you're right. I think just thinking about what's actually novel at the base of what you're talking about, what is unique about what you're doing, and can you wrap your arms around that? I think there's a lot of strength if you can start out with that foundation. And there's a lot of value. Look, you don't have a ton of value as a company if you don't have unique IP. You can have know-how, but if you don't have unique protectable matter, like a patent that's very strong, it's going to be really hard to get investment and to move forward.
Oh, that's for sure. And then I liked your advice as well, where you can't expect the patent attorney to understand ophthalmology like you do. You're going to have to do all the writing.
Yeah, we're the subject matter expert, and so there's no sort of goofing off or cutting corners or going halfway. If you're in it, you're in it, and that includes the patent writing as well. You got to be deep into it. Roll up your sleeves and start writing.
Yes, it's great. We're in process now of kind of seeing what we can do with our patent, either license it or have it acquired by another company, but time will tell. But I've already got the wheels churning, thinking of other things I got to figure out.
That's exciting. Yeah, I wish you luck with that. It's not easy to do those things. Licensing, selling, all those things are extremely hard. A lot of luck involved with them as well. So I wish you luck with that.
Oh, thank you. Now, any other questions that you wanted to ask me? Because can you believe it? We've been talking for an hour already.
Yeah. So I do have one question, and we'll see if it resonates or not. So you've talked to a lot of ophthalmologists. You've given a lot of lectures. Is there a piece of advice from these podcasts that has changed the way that you live, just in your daily life? Have you taken a piece of advice or just a nugget from what somebody said, you know, whether it's Rich Davidson going heli-skiing with his kids or, you know, Daryl talking about his blogging with you? Is there something that sticks out as, hey, that was, I wouldn't have gotten that if I wasn't doing this type of work?
Yeah, the one thing that sticks is that we're all ophthalmologists. We all have something in common. We're all smart enough to get in ophthalmology. We all obviously love doing eye surgery, eye care, whatever. But we're also completely different.
Yeah.
You couldn't pay me to go heli skiing.
Same here, by the way.
Oh, you're out of your mind. But what's so interesting is the different aspects that they all bring. So every podcast to me is totally different. As people know, I don't script anything here.
Yeah.
This is literally just a conversation. Let's just see where it takes us. I don't have any questions to ask. I have no agenda. Let's just chit chat. So I just found that we're all similar in a very, you know, with ophthalmology, but otherwise we're all completely different.
Yeah. It makes it beautiful. Yeah. So we get to know each other and learn from each other. So I think that's one of the best things that we do. I think that's great.
Yeah. Another important lesson was that half the amazing things in your future that are coming, you just have no idea will come out of left field. You can't predict it. And sometimes it's like what you said, well, just knowing people for many years, being responsive, and sometimes it's just dumb luck. I happen to meet this person and
next
thing you know.
Or you answered the phone call or the email or the text. And that.
Right. That's actually so important. Yeah. I make it a point. Anyone who contacts me through Cataract Coach, any ophthalmologist around the world, 100% always reply back.
That's awesome. Yeah. I do want to thank you before we end here about, you know, everything that you've done. You're a part of the daily routine of not just me, but many others that I know with playing that video. Like I said, 3:01 is when it pops in my email and I'm usually up around then. I wake up early. So I get to start my day with you, whether you know it or not, right? And I think that's amazing. And thank you for all the teaching that you're doing. It's a resource where if I do a Google search on something like viscoelastics, how do I teach the resident how to differentiate between the viscoelastics? You're the number one hit, right? So so thank you for everything that you've done.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a, you know, it's a group effort. I get now, if you notice, I'm Cataract Coach, maybe one video a week will be me operating. Most are not me operating. Whereas the beginning, it was all my cases, only me operating.
Yeah.
But now I get 30 to 50 videos sent in a week.
Yeah,
and I go through every one of them.
Yeah, the network effect that you've created is not by accident. So people know if they have a cool video, probably when they're in the operating room and something happens, they're like, this one's for Uday. This one's going to cataractcoach.com. So I think the network effect is something you created. It's not by accident. Now you get to benefit from that. And we get to benefit from that. We get to see these things. So yeah, since you're
right. I get to see stuff that, gosh, like knock on wood, I've never seen.
Yeah.
Explosive hemorrhage, explosive choral hemorrhage.
Yeah.
Never seen it. Hope I never see it.
Yeah, yeah. Let me knock on the premiere too.
But at least there's a video of it. Like, okay, now I know what to do. Here's the issue. I gotcha.
Yeah.
It's kind of neat. Neat to have it on there.
I think it's neat, very informative, and certainly the residents appreciate it. They all know who you are. They all know the output. So I think it's amazing.
Tell the residents, hey, send in some videos.
Yeah.
Not good cases. We want complications. And all resident cases are anonymous.
We got to learn. Yeah. So I think I'll definitely mention that. I'll send out an email today.
I do appreciate it. All right. I want to thank you so much, Malik. What an incredible fun hour. Love talking to you. Thank you again for doing this.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I'll remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get your podcasts, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, there's still a new Cataract Coach video every single day, 2,500 plus and running. And now we have, of course, a new Retina Rounds video every single day. So until next time. Catch you later.